serving veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation today with 94-year-old Art Smith of Escondido, California. We also heard from his son, Dave Smith, founder of Honor Flight San Diego. That story goes all the way back to Art's Marine Corps service in World War II with the 1st Provisional Marine Brigade, a crucial component to the recapturing of Guam in late July and early August 1944. 1,700 Americans would lose their lives on Guam, 6,000 more injured. We heard how close Mr. Smith came to adding to one of those numbers, and perhaps he ultimately would have if he had not been pulled away from the front lines to work for the man who would control more than 200,000 American personnel as the island commander of Guam and its first post-war governor. How was it, Art, that you ended up working for General Henry Larson?
They wanted somebody to help with the correspondence, and they look over their records and they say, hey, you got a guy out here to take shorthand, and he's going to be a court reporter, and we need somebody to work along with the notices that go around Guam. And his adjutant, his name was Thompson, I believe, he interviewed me, and he says, we want you up here to help with the correspondence. So I've got letters going out of Guam from the general.
So General Larson is in charge of all the Marines on the island, and he finds out that you have the proclivity to do what he needs in typing out messages and distributing them. How far along into the battle for Guam did that happen?
Oh, I'd say a couple of weeks. They were just setting up an office. And then when you run into people that visit that office, like Admiral Nimitz, and you talk to them, you got the guy that's in charge of the whole Pacific Fleet. Man, that makes you feel like, look at these individualized learning people that are at the top of the ray, and you're among them.
Did that make you nervous to be around guys like Nimitz and Larson?
No, because they were working. They had a job to do, and they'd work it with you, and they never argued with you. They'd say, this is it. We got to get it out now. And they were true people that could run a show. And like he said in the letter he gave me when the war ended, he says, you may not think much of what you accomplished in this war, but the time will come when you will realize that you were part of the victory. From a general to me.
Well, and I guess one question that comes to mind for me, how different was that from what you were doing before? From coming ashore as Marine in this invasion and sleeping in foxholes and all that and that constant enemy threat to then going to work for the general, I imagine that changed the existence that you had on Guam, changed the way you lived day to day. Can you give us a taste of how different that was?
Well, it wasn't where you'd got royalty and the best of everything, like the best food and everything else. You still got a lot of packages. But they had a war to run, and they run it great, those leaders. I'll tell you, they knew what was going on. But you were just there to make the war end as soon as you could and do the best you could.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong here. Here's what I'm thinking. You're a guy that could have stayed in the States in a factory making propellers and not ever gone over, but you wanted to serve. You could have stayed at Camp Elliott doing the job they gave you there, but you wanted to go overseas and be part of the action. Now you're in the action. You're on Guam, recapturing this island. But the general snatches you up and, if I'm not mistaken, gives you a safer job, right? Were you in danger less doing that duty compared to when you were out there fighting?
You never know. The war hadn't ended yet. There's still fighting going on.
And I guess, in theory, being around those guys could put you in more danger because they were top targets. If the enemy knew where they were, they'd love to take them out.
Well, I got on deals like taking Japanese prisoners to Saipan. There was about 20 I was in charge of a group that I took over to Saipan. And you go up rope ladders with them, and you watch them, and you're like a policeman then. You know, besides doing correspondence, they had me doing other stuff. And we're going back from Saipan. We flew over Rota, and we were being shot at. So the war was still there, and I was still, you never know. Who's going to turn the general down when he says, we want you up there in our office, you know? But it inspired me. Look what it did. When I got out, I was shy a little, but I taught a Toastmasters class at Michigan State. Then I got into buying, and I was director of purchasing for a couple of plants. But it's all the background that I got from those people that were generals, and you can do it, you know?
Well, and Secretary Forrestal, when writing about what you did, talks about fighting your way yard by yard through swamps and dense jungles and over cliffs, that you were terrifically reduced in strength because of the enemy's fanatical counterattacks? In a time like that, how do you deal with the fact that your numbers are dwindling, that you're losing guys, that people are getting killed and wounded, and you don't have as many Marines as you did the day before? Does that discourage you? Does it get you down?
You don't think about that. You're part of it. You hope you get out of it. I mean, if you got to help somebody by your side, you'll fight for them. They did for me. Like I said, I could have got it when I got a shot that hit my helmet and took my windshield out.
So that was my question. If the timing of that assignment to the general maybe spared you from being in a situation that could have cost you your life.
Well, that's, I'm sure of it. If I hadn't had that being a court reporter background, I'd still be the fighting part. But now I was corresponding with the whole people of Guam, and you're with the general that runs Guam. I don't prefer to be a hero or anything. I didn't ask for combat, but it was there. And all of a sudden it wasn't there. It was administrative. But it was with great people. It'll be history. Nimitz in charge of the Navy, they'll never forget him. And as you're talking to him, and what are you? You know, college grads. When the war ended, they got you going home. They had taken over the island of the Japanese soldiers and everything else. And before I know it, I'm walking across the field with Japanese soldiers. They're cleaning up the grounds and everything else. And they see me carrying a Japanese sword. I know they waited at that, as I was heading for the boat to go home.
What was it like to come home?
I got into the Chicago area, and I couldn't get out. I was on Christmas Day I got discharged. Can you imagine that? They kept us from getting discharged Christmas Eve so that they could spend a good time, and I'm on Sunday, and I can't get out. So when I finally got out to Lansing, Michigan, I walked down the street. It was in an early morning with my bag on my shoulders and went from one store to another looking in the windows. Early in the morning, and I looked at a racket with all our names on it. I went by the Strand Theater, and I used to go to the movies there. And then I knocked on the door of my mother's, and she says, "Where have you been?" She said, "Your brother and sister have been down here from Chicago." And I said, "Mom, I just got in." "Here, you've been away all these years. And you're catching heck for getting home."
I bet there were a few nights on Guam where you weren't sure when or if you were going to see your mom again.
Well, that's true. I mean, how do you know? I mean, what's going to catch you? You've seen them there where letters are going to go out. It could have been you. It really brings, you're a young man, and there's a young man there. It's no more. It's in plastic bags and getting ready, and mother's going to get it, and they're going to cry. And so I'm lucky I got out.
And what did that feel like to see your family again?
Well, when I got finally back home, but it's still, the war was still with me because my mother and dad had this little apartment, and I got a bedroom upstairs. And she said, "At night you yell and scream and everything else." They tell me this is from the war, what you'd gone through. She said, "Why are you up there yelling and screaming and crying?" But I couldn't help it. Post-traumatic something. So it shows I must have been seeing something.
Did that persist? Do you still deal with that occasionally?
No.
The thought occurred to me that maybe that's one of the reasons it's hard for you to discuss what happened when you got the samurai sword. When you think about that, does that trigger those feelings?
I don't claim to be a hero.
Two things on that, and you're not alone. You know, I call this program Hometown Heroes, and every veteran I've ever interviewed, I think, has said, "Hey, wait a second, I'm not a hero. The heroes are the guys who didn't come home. 406,000 Americans in World War II. But you have that samurai sword because the guy who was carrying it was trying to kill you. So you would have been one of those 406,000. We're not saying you're a hero. We're saying we're aware that you very easily could have died. And in that instance, you almost died had you not overpowered him. And I'm sorry if I've pushed you too far on that. I know you're very humble and you're not looking for attention for it. For me, it just underscores that thin line between life and death.
But I don't claim to be a hero in anything. But I just was there where heroes were.
You mentioned the post-traumatic stress that you experienced when you first got back, and you're not alone. So many veterans, and I talked to guys today pushing 100 years old who are still having flashbacks. Did it ever weigh on you, or did you have to wrestle emotionally or mentally because you knew that you were killing the enemy?
If I didn't kill back, they'd kill. Like I said, when that stress, finally, my mother couldn't put up with it, so I went to live at the YMCA to get away until I had to work it out myself. But then things started to work out.
How'd you do that? How did you find healing from that or just the ability to function without that
happening? When I went to YMCA, the people treated me great. You know, I know my mother, she says I couldn't put up with it. And then I went to work, like I said, on a night shift. I didn't know what to do with myself. You're still trying to find yourself. And cutting steel at 10 o'clock at night. And then they run it through hammers in a hammer shop. And then they brought me up front. And when I brought my son in to work there at that plant. And he said, Dad, they said, they all say that you started at the bottom and you're working on yourself right to the top.
Well, tell me about the honor flight. When you got to go back to Washington, D.C. and see that World War II memorial and a lot of other things, including the Marine Corps memorial, where it says, among the Marines in the Pacific, uncommon valor was a common virtue, a quote by that very admiral that you were hanging out with on Guam, Admiral Nimitz. What was that experience like for you?
Oh, God. I got the call and it says, you got a chance to go. You have to have a guardian. Well, I called my son. And I said, will you be my guardian? He says, yeah. Well, they took us back and he enjoyed it so much. You know what he's done. Yeah. He's over 1,000 he sent back just because he was my guardian and he got interested in it. Then when I saw Washington, the Marines were here and police escorts and they deserved it, you know.
At the National World War II Memorial itself, when you see that wall of gold stars and it says this represents the 406,000 Americans who died in World War II and it says underneath, here we mark the price of freedom. What did you think about as you're looking at that?
I felt sorry for him. What can you say? I mean, was it worth it? You know, I mean, look at those stars in there. They had families, probably children, wives, husbands. You don't spend too much time on it because it's done, but it's a shame.
And if you had been one of them, that son who's standing there next to you at that memorial wouldn't be here.
Yeah, it's true, but that's the way destiny is.
Well, speaking of destiny, how do you explain all this? How do you explain that 20-year-old who hit the shores of Guam went through everything that Forrestal talked about in that commendation, the enemy opposition that you faced, the close calls you endured. How do you explain that you survived it all and that you're still here?
I'm religious, not real strong, but I believe, and I think God helped me.
Is there one particular moment where you look back and say, yeah, that was divine, that was from up there?
Yes, what I told you, a sniper missed me. He could have got me and it would have been all over. Why did it have to happen there when I'm driving an officer in the back seat and he hits my helmet, takes my windshield off?
With Dave in honor flight, sounds like you're pretty proud of him and what he's done.
Oh, I walk out here and they're all wearing these caps. And I said, you know where you got those from? Yeah, Dave Smith. I said, that's my son. This is your son? Yeah. I said, you know Dave Smith? Yeah. Everybody knows Dave Smith. I'm real proud of what he's done.
And I know he's proud of you too. And I can tell you're proud to be a Marine. They say once a Marine, always a Marine. But what does that mean to you to be a Marine?
I can't be prouder than everybody else that went into the service. But I'm proud to be a Marine. I can't say we're better than the others. We're just there like they are when they were there. And then you meet somebody that was a prisoner of war on Guam and he comes up and gives you a hug, and you'd never seen him before in your life. He says, you were the Marines that recaptured Guam. And he says, I was a prisoner of war. And he put his arms around. I'll never forget that. It makes you feel like you did the right. Like these two women, the one that just called me. Her two daughters just came back from Guam. They were Agate, where I landed. They went all over it.
And you asked them to do something for you. Tell me what that was.
I told them to go to Agate, a couple other places, and told them about what went on. They did. And I said, what I'd like to have you do, and this is true, go to the burial places, and when you stand there, put your hand in the sluice a little like this, and say, thank God, and may you rest in peace. Sorry.
And they did that for you.
Yeah.
I can tell that means a lot to you. I can tell if you were able, you'd love to go there yourself and do the same thing.
I would. It's a wonderful place. And then to we have someone that was born on Guam, a woman, come up and give me a hug and a card that says, thank you for your saving. And my parents are still on the island. So you felt you did something good.
Without question, Guam remains part of the United States today. More than 160,000 of our American brothers and sisters are living there. And today, we met one of those who had a hand in setting the island free from Imperial Japan in 1944. Thanks again to Art Smith and his son, Dave. You can learn more about Honor Flight San Diego and the Honor Flight Network through the links that are up for you at hometownheroesradio.com. We're out of time for today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.